Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk radio show host, Randy Fine. Today we are going to be talking about something really brand new and exciting. Maybe it's not so new, maybe it's actually very old, but sometimes we are not in touch with these things because modern society has changed our way of thinking. But we are going to be talking about what's called Dharma parenting. And you may have heard Dharma, and you may have heard the word Dharma, but not associated with parenting. So we're going to learn from the authors of the book, Dharma Parenting, Understand Your Child's Brilliant Brain for Greater Happiness, Health, Success, and Fulfillment, which is written by my guests today, Dr. Robert Keith Wallace, and Dr. Frederick Travis. So let's get started so we can hear all this exciting information, and let me introduce my guests to you. I've been honored to call them Keith and Fred, so that's what we're going to do. Good morning, Keith and Fred.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Randy. Great to be here.
Thank you. It's so great to have you. Okay, so Dharma parenting. Let's start by explaining what that is.
Well, Dharma is a, as you mentioned, it's a very old word. It has this marvelous different connotations in the Eastern traditions. For us, the word is really means the path of life that is going to bring the greatest happiness, success, and fulfillment. So finding your Dharma is finding your path, and Dharma parenting is helping your child find their perfect path in life that will bring them the greatest fulfillment.
And, you know, as I told you before we went on air, I love that because I just so believe in proper parenting and anything that guides people to developing a successful child into a successful adult is right up my alley, and I believe in it so much. Children are different, and I think that's what people don't understand. Children come into this world with different likes and dislikes and predispositions. So, and you talk about it in terms of three brain body types. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is such a fundamental point. Children have their own tendencies, their own preferences, their own way in life. And these have been delineated by the ancient medical science of Ayurveda in India, and they're called dosha types. And before I go on, it's important to know that this typing isn't to give excuses for children's bad behavior or to label people, but rather just to recognize that children have their own nature. And what we have in the core of Dharma parenting is to discover your child's brain-body tendencies, their nature. And for this, we actually have a quiz, which is on our website, www.dharmaparenting.com. And you can see what are the natural strengths, what are the preferences of your child, and also of you. From that, then you can understand why one child likes hot chilies, and the other one, every time they eat hot chilies, they start arguing with their siblings, and they get angry. Why some child love to be outside in the sun and other people just enjoy the shade. So understanding the nature of your child allows you to support their growth as a unique human being. And rather than imposing the direction you think they should go, recognizing where they want to go.
And there are three types. Can you explain what they are, please?
Sure, that's easy. So the first one is the we refer to as the Vata brain body type. It's V-A-T-A. It's this word which has an indication of movement or wind. And this type of child is the one that's super imaginative, creative, always learning new things, quick to pick things up. But if they get imbalanced, they can get a little nervous and anxious. The next type is the Pitta type, P-I-T-T-A, and that is kind of the fiery type, the goal-oriented type, the type that's always has a purpose in mind, can be very competitive, very athletic, can be quite a strong leader. But if they become out of balance, they can get angry and very irritable. And finally, the Kapha type is the one that is the steadiest, little more easygoing, friendly, but again, if they're, you know, they can be absolutely fantastic in a family because they glue everything together, but if they get out of balance, then they can get a little withdrawn and even depressed. So each of these different types has their tendencies, their strengths, and their weaknesses, and the real trick is to keep each type in balance. And of course, no one person is purely one or the other. I mean, that's very rare. Mostly we're a combination. So you'd find out that you might be, you know, part Vata, part Pitta. You can be very imaginative, but also goal-oriented. And so this kind of understanding of your children really helps you, first of all, to help them keep in balance and help yourself keep in balance. And second of all, it helps you understand what these different types are like when they collide, because you can have one type of mom that's very fiery or a dad, and they're, you know, very pitta, very goal-oriented, athletic, trying to push the kids into athletics and everything. But then you can have a child that is more vata in nature, and they're really more interested in, you know, doing creative arts, music. They're more sensitive, more delicate. And it's just a question of making sure that you don't impose your tendencies on your child's tendencies.
Right. And that's something no parent should ever do, because every child is different. I mean, we all know if you have more than one child, each of your children are very, very different. You never have two of the same personalities. And so you have to parent according to you know, who that child is and what their needs are. Some are easier to parent, some are not, you know. I had my children were worlds apart. My daughter was she never did anything wrong. She was smart. She, you know, everything went well. You just put her anywhere and she cooked. My son was not like that. He required a lot of management and handling and understanding and, you know, guidance and that kind of thing. And they both turned out very well, equally well. But you know, somehow I understood it. I don't know how, but I never had a guide, and this really would have helped. So what do you do now that you, once you're aware of the this that your child is a pitta, vata, or kapha, pitta or kapha. Okay, there we go. Once you're aware that your child is one of these types or a combination of two or more of these types, then what do you do?
Well, it's a matter of, with information, you're forearmed. That is, you know about foods. You know that they should eat. You know about if you're going shopping and it's going to go over lunchtime. If your child is a kapha nature, then it's fine. They can miss lunch. If your child is a pitta nature, they're just explode at 12:01. And so it helps you anticipate. It helps you foresee. It helps you understand the child. Why is your child so angry? Well, it could simply be because they missed a meal. It could be because they were watching a television show, which was very dynamic and active. Say if they're a vata type, they're very affected by sensory information coming in. So it really gives you a roadmap to understand what is happening to your child and also to plan. And also what I found is great for siblings. I have three children. Two are pitta nature. One is kapha nature. And once they understood this, and the kapha nature said, who wants to go out and get a dessert with me? And the other two girls would look at each other and roll their eyes. There was no need to go out and get dessert with this, with their sister. You know, she can get it herself. But realizing her nature, they went out with her one at a time. And so you begin to appreciate differences. And I think this generalizes across dealing with relationships in general. Because you realize that everyone is not like you. Most people think Everyone is like you. They see the world the way I do. They react to the world the way I do because that's your experience. And this teaches you everyone is different is actually seeing the world differently. And so you can begin to appreciate that and allow that difference to continue.
That's true. No two people perceive things the same way. And that's what gets us into trouble in relationships is that we think everyone sees things the way that we do. And this is, like you say, a roadmap to explain why that happens. And, you know, I want to back up a little bit because I always read a bio about my guests, and I didn't read your bio. So I just want to tell my listeners that that Robert Keith Wallace, Dr. Robert Keith Wallace, is a pioneering researcher on the physiology of consciousness. And his research has inspired hundreds of studies on the benefits of meditation and other mind-body techniques. And his findings have been published in many, many journals and magazines. And Dr. Fred Travis is a world-renowned neuroscientist who has discovered brainwave patterns in children and young people that correlate with greater moral reasoning, happiness, emotional stability, and academic performance. And Dr. Travis has authored or co-authored 70 scientific papers, many published in peer review journals. So with that said, is there a science behind this, behind Dharma parenting?
And I think it's quite interesting. Ayurveda for years, you know, was not really regarded as mainstream science, and more recently now, people have come out and done some very interesting research using genetic analysis and looking at gene expression and finding that the collection of genes for the pitta is quite different than the vata and quite different than the kapha. So there seems to be a strong genetic basis to this. And also if you look at biochemical measures, that's also true. So these kinds of findings are telling us right away that there is a different kind of neural network that's formed in each of these children. Now, we know that the brain changes with experience, so nothing is fixed and it's always changing, but some of these circuits that come from birth and come from early childhood are incredibly powerful and they have a very, very lasting effect on our lives. Fred here is a great expert on all the different stages of development, so I'll let him explain a little of that.
Yeah, this is another insight from Dharma parenting, is not only do people come in with their own nature, but throughout this first 25 years of life, the brain, which is what's allowing them to interact with the world, is dynamically changing. For instance, between birth and age 3, the child is gaining 24 million new connections every minute. That's why they're able to, in a matter of 6 months, learn to control their body. I mean, it's incredible. They come in, and they don't have connections to move their arms and their legs, but then they're able to move their head and keep their gaze. They're able to wire up the sensory system so you can take all of this information from the eyes and make it into a concrete object. And this is happening through this explosion of connections. By age 3, the child can see objects, manipulate objects, and at this point, the thickness of the surface of their brain is twice as thick as yours or mine, Randy, twice as thick as any adult. And what this is doing is giving them ready-made connections from age 3 to age 10 to quickly pick up language, rule-governed behavior, socialization. And so what you want to do between those times between 3 and 10 is talk with them. They want to hear words, read to them. You want to give them a space to play, because as they pick up language, they can take the language, which is a symbol, and they can transform an object. So they get a box, and the box could be a dragon, could be a horse, it could be a hamburger, and they can transform it and play with it as though that's what it is. And what this is doing is they're exercising their ability to think. Beginning about age 10 to age 18, they lose connections. It's a process called pruning. And it's like pruning a bush at home. When you prune a bush at home, you cut off branches, it leaves physical space, and suddenly the bush flourishes. And this is what's happening in the child's brain. The connections they haven't used are dropping off. The connections they have used are strengthening, and their sense of individuality begins to emerge. But about age 13 or 14, they're right in the middle of this pruning period, and the brain they go to bed with is the brain they wake up with.
Wow.
And it's that which allows us to understand the world. That interface is, it's getting holes in it just day by day. Their sense of self is very fragile. They can't remember any complex series of tasks. You ask them to do 3 things, they do the first one, they forget the other 2. And they're not being bad. They're not acting out. It's literally the brain connections are just changing that quickly. Something else that's happening in the teenage years is the axons that connect the other parts of the brain with the front of the brain are gaining a fatty layer. It's called myelin. And this speeds up information flow. So at age 12 or age 13, all the other aspects of the child's brain are completely developed. They're in this time of massive pruning, and they're not able to see the bigger picture. The connections with the frontal lobes is what allows them to see the big picture, and they're not there. So the child will make mistakes. They'll make decisions because they don't see what's the larger ramifications. Now, these connections with the frontal lobes continue from age 12 up through age 25. So even when our children go off to college at age 18, they don't have all of the neural circuits they need to really see the big picture to make big decisions. And so in Dharma parenting, we speak about what do you want to do from 0 to 3. You just want to love and give the child attention, because that's the experience that helps to build nourishing circuits. Between 4 and age 9, you want to speak to them. They want to gain language. You want to give them at 7, 8, and 9 rule-governed situations, because now they can begin to incorporate rules to govern behavior. And then in the teen years, that's when you want to give them complex problems. You want to, as if, give them a way to exercise these global frontal circuits. That's when you want to allow them to make decisions and see what's the consequence of this decision. Because in essence, you want to have those circuits beginning to be in place so when they go out into the world, they can make decisions. They can see the big picture.
This is so fascinating. So are these ages and the development associated with the ages, is this sort of carved in stone? I mean, do some people have this come together before the age of 25, but maybe 22, 23, or is it really very, very much associated to the age, the number of years?
The ages are approximate. So some children, 22, 23, some adults never develop those circuits. They estimate 15 to 20% of adults think like 10-year-olds. They think very concretely. You're either with me or against me. It's my way or the highway. It's black and white. They think very stereotypically. And I think those adults, as children, haven't had the chance to think outside the box. They were never required to see the big picture. And it could also be their upbringing. If you're under stress, if you're in abuse, those connections don't develop because you live more in a survival mode. So what is happening is experience is dynamically interacting with ongoing maturation from inside, and that's determining the brain circuits we have. And this is the key part about parenting. When you interact with your child, you're actually building their brain circuits.
Very, very cool stuff. This is so important for everyone to know. This is the manual that people should leave the hospital with after they give birth.
I agree.
Yeah, it's so interesting that parents, you know, you go to college and you never take a course on how to parent, and that's probably, one of the most important things you're going to do when you graduate. So the reality of life is that we all need this kind of information. It's very, very helpful.
I agree. And how wonderful the world would be if everyone was parented properly. So you've mentioned the word Ayurvedic a few different times, but I doubt that many of my listeners understand what Ayurvedic, what it is. Can you explain?
Well, it's an ancient system of health, like we have Chinese traditional medicine, we have Ayurveda. Almost in every country in the world you go, you'll find there's some traditional system of health. And up to now, we really haven't understood what the value of these traditions are. I mean, last year, the Nobel Prize was given to a lady in China who actually had used the knowledge of herbal medicine. She had used some modern techniques to help in managing, a very terrible disease in the world. So the reality is this knowledge is quite profound, and we're now discovering many of the different herbs and spices that have been in these traditions have a very powerful effect. There are literally thousands of studies on the bioactivity of these. And also many of these traditions had some sort of mind-body understanding. They knew that by changing the consciousness of the individual, you could change the physiology. For example, in Ayurveda, there's a very strong emphasis on meditation, on really changing the consciousness of the person. We are, researchers who have studied meditation a lot. We've looked particularly at transcendental meditation, but there have been some amazing studies on it to show, in fact, that it has a very, very powerful effect on helping not only prevent disease, but cure diseases. There was one recent study that looked at several hundred people done at University of Wisconsin, supported by an NIH grant, very well-controlled study, and it found a 48% reduction in risk for heart attacks, strokes, or death. Now, if you had a pill like this, it would be a billion-dollar pill. And people are kind of familiar with taking pills. They're not so familiar with changing their lifestyle, meditating, doing yoga, doing exercise, having a better diet. But that's really what these ancient techniques emphasize, were lifestyle changes. They do have herbs, and they do have spices, and they do have a variety of different techniques. But ultimately, their most powerful technique was prevention, just enabling people to live a better lifestyle. And modern medicine is recognizing this. It's very interesting. Modern medicine is now validating a lot of these ancient truths in Ayurveda and Chinese traditional medicine. Not only the herbs, but the lifestyles, whether it's meditation, whether it's yoga, whether it has to do with any particular specific technique. What we're finding really is that there's a lot of wisdom in these ancient traditions, and that they're very valuable. And some of the mainstream new trends in medicine, such as lifestyle medicine, that's really what it's doing, is kind of using some of this ancient knowledge, but putting it in modern terminology, or even there's a whole area called personalized medicine. Now, they want to look at your genetic blueprint. But in fact, these ancient traditions understood this individuality, and they knew these tendencies. Of course, it's fantastic with genetic techniques. You can find, you know, whether a drug can be metabolized more easily in one person than another just by looking at the expression of specific genes. But that same knowledge was there through different procedures. They have these wonderful techniques in Ayurveda called pulse diagnosis, where they can take a person's pulse and actually determine the level of vata, pitta, and kapha, and detect stages of a disease long before it manifests into what we would normally consider a disease. So it's a very, very powerful preventive program, and now being recognized. The many different aspects of it are being recognized and better understood by modern science. There's this whole area of the gut bacteria, which I don't think anybody had any idea. It's about to change modern medicine entirely. But Chinese traditional medicine, Ayurveda, they put a huge emphasis on digestion and that food is medicine. And nobody has really understood this. I mean, it's been kind of a puzzle. Why should this work? And now we know that, strangely enough, all those bacteria that are living in our gut, they turn out to be mostly friendly, you know, like 30 trillion of them. And they actually turn out to be very supportive. They determine our depression, whether we're depressed, whether we're happy. They determine whether we get Alzheimer's. They might determine whether we have an autoimmune disease, whether we have asthma. And so the state of them is very much determined by the diet we take. So now we're beginning to understand why they put so much emphasis on diet and digestion. And it's only kind of the new revelations in modern science that are helping us to not treat these as folk medicines, but as great wisdom that had been lost over many hundreds of years.
Right. And Ayurvedic medicine has its roots in India, right? Is that,
yes,
am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Which is the same where also transcendental meditation comes from. And, the ancients were brilliant. They really were. And I know I used to practice TM, and I know I could slow my heart rate down, you know, within minutes, just by doing the mantra, you know, everything would slow down. And I thought that was very, very cool. We're almost 30 minutes into the hour. Is there anything that we haven't brought up that you think is real important to talk about?
There is one thing, and that is Dharma parenting includes six tools. And you can remember these tools because by remembering the word Dharma. So the first tool is discover your child in your own brain, body, nature, brain-body tendencies. The second is heal thyself. H is heal thyself. An important point for parents. And you need to sleep. You need to rest. This is where meditation is very important. You need to take a 20-minute vacation and just dive it in, recharge, so you can come back out and be the parent you want to be. A stands for attention and appreciation. That, I think, is what we do as parents, is just be alert to what your child is doing. They're not an inanimate object. They're a constantly growing, dynamic person. And see what's coming out. What's their new insight? What's their level of understanding now? And this attention is one that's of appreciation. It's not discrimination. It's not judgment. It's not comparing. Oh, your sister did this 2 weeks ago or something. But really appreciate their steps of growth. R stands for routines. Routines help to stabilize and smooth family life. And many routines, going to bed routines, routines when you go shopping, family meeting routines where you actually sit together as a family and discuss things. M is manage meltdowns. Meltdowns can occur, do occur, and we have six C's that help you manage the meltdowns. And the last A stands for anticipate and adapt. Anticipate. Now you know the nature of your children, of yourself. You can anticipate what might happen. But if something comes up that you didn't anticipate, and then you adapt. We give you the, we empower you, we trust you, we know that your intuition about what you should do at any moment for your child will probably be right. So these are six tools which are part of Dharma Parenting. The book is available at Amazon.com and also all bookstores. It's a Tarcher Penguin print. And also visit our website, dharmaparenting.com. And what you'll see there is the quiz that you can take to find out your nature and your children's nature. You'll find blog posts that we've done, ongoing research, and we hope to have many interactive aspects on there in the future.
Excellent. Why? How long did it take you to study this, and then how long before you wrote this book were you? Did you begin studying this?
Well, first, it took about 28 years raising our kids.
Well, a little longer. I got four kids and six grandchildren, so a lot of years of experience here, that's for sure. The book took us about 3 years to do. We really had to do a lot of research in terms of all the parenting techniques that are out there. We have been studying, meditation and mind-body research for many years before that, so we had a lot of research under our belt already. We also have at the university we're at, Maharishi University of Management, both of us are professors here and are in charge of students who are learning about Ayurveda, learning about transcendental meditation, so we've had a lot of experience there also. It's hard to put a number on it because there's so many years of different aspects that we've both been involved in.
It was a delight to do, though, Randy, because we had the benefit of knowing about the nature body type and the nature of individuals, about the pitta and kapha, as our children were growing up. And so we got to see how this could be useful. And that, in combination with our research and knowledge of the brain, sort of brought together this understanding of Dharma parenting.
Oh, that's so wonderful. And so the two of you just like all of a sudden said, let's write a book.
Pretty much. Pretty much. I mean, you think, hey, I'm 71. I've got, six grandchildren. How could I, as my kids said, how can you write a book on parenting now? That's a good point. But I think we just realized that one of the most profound applications of all this knowledge we've been looking at was in this area. We've certainly done a lot of other applied areas of this knowledge, whether it's looking at blood pressure or looking at anxiety or looking at, so many different applications of both transcendental meditation and Ayurveda. But we hadn't actually thought about parenting, and then it just came to us, hey, this is a good idea. We should do this. I mean, our children are, I have grandkids. I mean, now's the time. We can pass that wisdom on. Otherwise, it gets lost.
Yeah, we've been publishing scientific papers since 1997. And so we've always been going back and forth talking about models and research and so on. So it is interesting how this emerged.
Yeah. It is, because, I've written a few books, and it's just, you don't even realize you're going to write a book, and one day it's like, I think I'm going to write a book, it just hits you, and then you start. So I get it. I really do get it. You can accumulate a lot of knowledge, and then all of a sudden you realize this could go into a book. Let's talk a little bit about transcendental meditation. Most people heard that, a certain generation heard about transcendental meditation when the Beatles first started. I don't know if all my listeners were even around at that time yet, but I remember hearing it, and it seemed so way out and so crazy. But I know that when both of my children were little and I was having terrible anxiety, I began practicing it. And what I would do is, because I had a little boy who was still taking naps, I would put him in the room with me. And it created such a peaceful nap for him. He would go right to sleep. Whereas if I would put him in his bed, he wouldn't sleep. But the energy of the room, as I went into, you know, the transcendental meditation, he went so peacefully to sleep. And I used to love that. I thought it was great. And a lot of time, you know, it's recommended to go off and kind of get away from your children to do this. For me, I didn't necessarily have to do that.
Very good. We affect the environment that we're in. So as you were transcending inside your mind was settling down to deep inner peace. You're actually structuring that around you as your son experienced. Yeah, the thing about not meditating with your children in the room is you just don't want to be disturbed. But what you did was absolutely right.
There's this great seminar, and it's on a website, tm-autism.org. And on this, it's all about really trying to understand how TM can help autistic kids. And one of the stories in it is of a mom who really wanted her child to learn TM. And the kid had a lot of problems, couldn't, you know, communicate very well at all. And so they had different ways in which the child learned how to communicate. But then they were just curious, could this child learn transcendental meditation with all these problems? And so she had her child learn transcendental meditation. And in the beginning, you know, they usually learn after the age of 10 to do the sitting technique of transcendental meditation. In the beginning, he could only sit for maybe 2 minutes. He just couldn't handle it. And then she would always meditate with him. And now, you know, they meditate regularly together, and he meditates the full time. You know, he's older, so based on his age. But it's really charming that, you know, she really looks forward to it. He looks forward to it. The family is fairly wealthy, and so they actually started, he wanted to start a foundation to help other children learn transcendental meditation. So it's called the Joey Lowenstein Foundation. And it's just kind of one of those great stories of how, you know, as you're saying, there are moments when it's a perfect opportunity. You know, lots of times families will meditate together. And that's a very charming and kind of wonderful experience for the family. So there are many instances where it's perfectly okay, you know, for the parents to meditate with the child, or, you know, in your case, where the child was anxious, to meditate in the same room. But lots of interesting and wonderful examples of how this works very well.
Right, and from what I remember in my training, you know, they say, the trainers say that you can really do TM anywhere. You could be on a crowded bus. And once you learn the technique, it just takes you right down, you know, into that transcendental state. So it's very convenient, but it is absolutely most wonderful when you are by yourself or with someone else who is in that same meditation. Can you explain a little bit about what TM is and how
sure.
it works?
I'd like to put it in a larger context of meditations in general, because there's different categories of meditation. One is focused attention, where you try to keep one experience in your mind. For instance, Zen meditation, keeping your attention on some part of the body, or Vipassana, where you're focusing on the breath and keeping the breath going. And these types of meditations allow you to strengthen the ability to focus the mind. You see a specific brain wave. It's a fast brain wave called gamma EEG. And you see that whenever you're focusing and controlling the mind. Another category of meditations allow you to just have any experience pass through awareness, but this happens with just watching the experience. It's open monitoring meditations. Rather than evaluating or judging, you simply note and let go. And when you're doing this type of process, following internal mental processing, the brainwave you see is called theta EEG. It's 4 to 8 cycles per second. And you see this whenever you're thinking through, say, your route home when you're going to be driving, or if you're thinking about friends. And in this meditation, this category of meditations, are meditations like mindfulness, also Kriya Yoga. Now, there's a third category, and that's automatic self-transcending. And that's any meditation that starts from the level of thinking and just takes you to being, inner silence. And that's where transcendental meditation is. By analogy, you can see transcendental meditation as like a scuba diver, where you start on the surface of the water and you just go through the deeper levels, quieter levels of the water till you get to the very bottom. And this is what we're doing 20 minutes twice a day. It's like taking a vacation. Your attention turns within. You just explore the inner silence, which is there, which is underlying, permeating our experience. And then when we come out, we bring a little more of that into activity.
It's wonderful. And you know, the difference for my listeners, difference between TM and other meditations, is that TM requires training. And so you have to go to these centers that train you for this, because it's not something you just learn on your own. And you are assigned a mantra, so you can't really do this by yourself, but it is well worth the training, you know, taking the time to do the training. Well, we're out of time. We've been talking with Robert Keith Wallace, PhD, and Frederick Travis, PhD, about their book, Dharma Parenting. And this has been such a fascinating show that I know we have all learned a lot from. So I want to thank both of you, Keith and Fred, for being my guests today and bringing this book to all our attention. I really wish you great success, and I hope that every family has this book in their library.
Thank you very much. Great talking with you, Randy.
Yeah, thank you, Randy.
Okay. Well, take care. Take care. I wish you great success.
Bye.
So we are finished. We're out of time, but all my shows are archived after broadcasting, and they can be listened to at your convenience on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, or through the show links on my website. So thanks again for tuning in and listening to A Fine Time for Healing. This is Talk Radio show host and author Randy Fine, signing off until next time. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randy Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randygfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randy G. Fine. That there